Imagine you've just won a major lawsuit, right? You've been fighting tooth and nail for years. The gavel finally comes down, the paperwork is signed, and you have this court order staring right back at you.
Oh, that's such a great feeling.
Right. It legally guarantees a settlement of exactly $150,000. You take a deep breath. It's finally over. You think, well, the system actually worked.
Yeah, that's that rare moment of pure closure in the legal world. The debt is formally recognized, the scales are balanced, and you can finally begin to move on with your life.
You feel totally vindicated, but then the weeks roll by, the check never arrives in the mail. You try to contact the company you sued, and it's like they've just vanished,
Totally ghosted.
completely ghosted. And when you finally force them to answer your questions, they look you dead in the eye and claim they, quote, only deal in cash.
Which is always a huge red flag.
Right. And on top of that, their own company president doesn't even know what the company does or who owns it. Your big victory lap just turns into this maze of smoke and mirrors.
It really is the ultimate legal bait and switch. You've got a piece of paper saying you're owed a fortune, and an opposing party doing literally everything in their power to make sure that paper remains completely worthless.
Exactly.
Because getting a judgment is often just, the opening skirmish. Enforcing it is where the real war of attrition begins.
So welcome to today's deep dive. We're cracking open a truly wild piece of source material today. It's a 2024 appellate court opinion from the Third District Court of Appeal in Florida.
It's a fascinating one.
It is. The case is called Garcia v. Yellow Cab. And our mission today is to explore the absolute extremes a company will go to in order to avoid paying a legally binding judgment.
And we'll see how they tried to use their own lawyer as a human shield, basically.
Right, and more importantly, we'll break down the heavy-duty legal tools the courts use to just tear down that facade.
It really serves as a great look at the mechanics of accountability. We often think of the law as this self-executing machine, right? But this case reveals how much heavy lifting is actually required when a corporate entity just refuses to participate in reality.
Yeah, you've probably signed contracts in your life or expected someone to make good on a debt. But what happens when the entity that owes you money pretends to be completely hopelessly clueless?
How does the legal system actually catch them?
Exactly. So let's set the stage. This whole saga doesn't start in a boardroom. It starts on the road, all the way back in 2013.
A completely ordinary beginning to a highly unusual legal fight.
Right. So in 2013, a man named Alexander Garcia gets into a serious auto accident. The vehicle that hit him was a cab. So Garcia does what anyone would do. He files a negligence lawsuit to recover damages for his injuries.
Makes sense.
Yeah, he originally sues two individuals, Carlos Gallardo and Edward Vitale. And eventually, he adds Yellow Cab Company to the lawsuit as a defendant.
And it's worth pausing just to note the timeline here. He files the suit in 2013, right? The legal wheels turn agonizingly slow. Depositions, discovery, procedural motions, all of this just drags out for nearly a decade.
A decade.
Yeah, for 9 years, Garcia is trapped in this holding pattern, just trying to get compensation for an accident that already upended his
Wow.
life.
So we fast forward to 2022. Garcia and Yellow Cab finally reach a resolution. Yellow Cab agrees to settle. They actually enter into a final consent judgment.
And that's a crucial distinction, actually.
Yeah.
A consent judgment isn't a jury coming back with a surprise verdict after a dramatic trial. It's an agreement.
Wait, so they willingly agreed to this?
Yes, Yellow Cab willingly agreed to the court entering a judgment against them for exactly $150,000 plus statutory interest. They actively participated in crafting this resolution.
Wow. Okay. So they shook hands on it, legally speaking. The court document explicitly acknowledged that a vehicle under the control of Yellow Cab caused the accident. It determined Garcia would recover that $150,000 settlement amount directly from Yellow Cab. And as part of this deal, the court dismissed the two individual drivers, Gallardo and Vitale, from the case entirely.
So Yellow Cab is left holding the bag. The full weight of the payment rests entirely on their shoulders by their own design.
By their own design. And then Yellow Cab simply doesn't pay. They agree to the judgment, the gavel comes down, and they just refuse to hand over the money.
Which is just, it's incredibly frustrating.
So Garcia realizes the money isn't going to just magically appear in his bank account. So he initiates post-judgment discovery. He basically tells the court, look, they owe me 150 grand and I need to find where they're hiding it.
Exactly, you have to hunt it down.
Right. So he subpoenas Yellow Cab for their basic financial documents and asks for the corporate representative with the most knowledge of the business operations to step forward.
And the list of documents Garcia requested was completely standard. If you're trying to track a company's assets, you ask for federal and state tax returns, bank statements, canceled checks, loan applications, balance sheets.
Just the normal stuff.
Exactly. He even asked for documents related to the insurance and registration of the specific cab involved in the accident.
Standard operating procedure. Show us your books so we can see how to get paid. And Yellow Cab's response to this totally normal request, they hand over exactly three documents.
Just three.
Three. And they weren't even internal company secrets. They were just public printouts from the Florida Department of State's SunBiz website, which, you know, anyone can look up.
Right, anyone with an internet connection.
Yeah.
And as for the tax returns, the bank statements, the canceled checks, Yellow Cab claimed they had absolutely none of it.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second. Their official excuse for not having a single corporate tax return or bank statement was that the corporation deals only in cash.
Yeah, that's what they went with.
A commercial taxi operation in 2022 claiming they have zero bank statements and deal entirely in unrecorded cash. It defies basic operational logic.
It really does.
I mean, you can't pay for a commercial fleet auto insurance policy with duffel bags of loose bills. It just doesn't compute. Are we really expected to believe this?
It strains credulity far past the breaking point, but we have to look at the underlying strategy here. This is a deliberate tactic, often referred to as judgment proofing.
Judgment proofing.
Yeah. It's where an entity structures its operations, assets, and liabilities specifically so that on paper, they appear completely destitute. They drain the entity of visible assets, so if a lawsuit hits, the plaintiff wins a hollow victory.
Because there's seemingly nothing to collect.
Exactly. They're daring Garcia to prove them wrong, knowing full well that proving a negative, proving that hidden bank accounts do exist, is incredibly resource intensive.
Man, that is sneaky. But Garcia couldn't just walk away from a $150,000 settlement. Since the paper trail was a total dead end, his only remaining option was to force a human being to sit in a room and answer for it.
Right.
He pivots and demands a corporate representative for an in-person deposition.
Under oath. Face to face.
Yep. So Yellow Cab sends their company president. He'd been serving in this role since 2022. You'd think the president of the company showing up to a legal deposition about a massive unpaid judgment would have at least, I don't know, brushed up on the facts.
You would hope so.
But this deposition transcript reads like a surrealist comedy. The president sits down and right out of the gate, he admits he reviewed exactly zero records before showing up.
Not a single one.
Nothing. He testifies he has absolutely no idea what the deposition is even about and couldn't even identify the other parties involved in the lawsuit.
He wasn't functioning as an executive in any traditional sense.
No, he wasn't an executive at all. He was just a designated sponge meant to soak up a subpoena without actually holding any water.
That's a good way to put it.
Garcia's lawyers ask him, who owns Yellow Cab? The president's answer, I don't know. They ask, does Yellow Cab keep any records? The answer, I have no idea.
Unbelievable.
Who would know? I have no idea. It's wild.
It's a masterclass in stonewalling, really. Designed to exhaust the plaintiff's legal budget.
It goes on to, they ask him if Yellow Cab has any bank accounts. I have no idea. They ask who pays the annual filing fee to the state of Florida. I have no idea.
It's just a broken record.
Literally. He didn't even know what the company's EIN was, which is insane. He admitted under oath that he communicates with nobody regarding business matters.
Yeah.
He didn't know if the company paid taxes, didn't know anything about lawsuits filed against the company, and had no idea who actually made decisions about those lawsuits.
And this brings us to the legal framework that this kind of behavior completely violates. There's a specific rule in play here. Florida Rule of Civil Procedure 1.310B6.
Okay, that's a mouthful.
Right. But this rule exists precisely to prevent a corporation from playing this exact game of hide and seek.
So how does that rule actually counter this strategy?
Well, when you subpoena a corporation, the corporation isn't a physical person. It has to designate a human representative to speak for it. But the law places an affirmative legal duty on the corporation.
Meaning they have to actually try.
Exactly. The representative must be prepared to testify about matters known or reasonably available to the organization. You have to educate your representative before they sit in that chair.
They can't just be completely blank.
No. They have to review documents, talk to past employees, look at the files. The corporation has a voice. and you cannot intentionally make that voice ignorant to dodge legitimate questions.
Okay, so you can't just grab a guy off the street, give him the title of president, and send him in completely blind. So if this president is literally just a guy in a chair who doesn't know anyone, who is actually pulling the strings.
The million-dollar question right there.
Someone has to be running the show, paying the filing fees, and making the decisions to settle lawsuits for 150 grand.
And during this absurd deposition, the clueless president accidentally lets a massive piece of the puzzle slip.
Oh, this is the best part. Amidst the endless sea of I have no ideas, the president is asked how he even got the job. He admits that the company's attorney, a man named Michael S. Kaufman, was the one who designated him as the corporate representative.
The lawyer picked him.
The lawyer picked him. And even better, he testified that if he suddenly quit or stopped serving as president, attorney Kaufman would just be the one to get a new president.
It's a stunning admission that completely shifts the landscape of the case. Hmm. I mean, the attorney isn't just providing legal counsel here. The attorney appears to be actively staffing the executive suite and managing the corporate structure.
Yeah. Garcia's lawyers hear this and realize they're wasting their time talking to a decoy. They suspend the deposition right then and there.
Smart move.
They realize the only person who actually knows anything about Yellow Cab's operations, its money, and its ownership is the lawyer himself.
Yeah.
So they subpoena attorney Kaufman.
Going right to the source.
Yep. They demand he sit for a deposition and bring documents. Specifically, his legal retainer agreement, records of all payments made to him from or on behalf of Yellow Cab, and the exact source of those payments.
Following the money.
They're following the money trail, and it leads straight to the lawyer's desk.
But naturally, an attorney is not going to just hand over their internal files without putting up a massive fight.
Oh, absolutely not. Yellow Cab immediately files a motion for a protective order. They tell the trial court, you can't depose our lawyer. That violates attorney-client privilege.
Which is a huge claim to make.
And surprisingly, the trial court agrees. The trial judge grants the protective order, completely blocking Garcia from questioning the lawyer.
Yeah, and we have to look at this from the trial judge's perspective for a moment. Trial judges are incredibly protective of attorney-client privilege. It's a foundational pillar of the legal system.
It makes sense they'd want to protect it.
Exactly. If a judge improperly forces a lawyer to breach that privilege, it's a guaranteed way to get their ruling overturned on appeal. So, when in doubt, trial judges tend to err on the side of caution and grant protective orders to shield attorneys from depositions. It's a defensive ruling.
But that puts Garcia in an impossible situation. The company's paperwork supposedly doesn't exist, the company's president knows nothing, and the trial court just ruled that the one guy who actually seems to be running things is legally untouchable.
Talk about hitting a brick wall.
You've got a $150,000 judgment, and the system is just shrugging its shoulders. But Garcia doesn't give up. He petitions the Florida 3rd District Court of Appeal, seeking a writ of certiorari.
Right.
Okay, writ of certiorari sounds a bit like an archaic spell, but my understanding of standard litigation is that if you hate a judge's ruling on a discovery issue, you just have to eat it until the case is completely over, and then you appeal.
That's usually how it works, yeah.
You can't just hit the pause button on the whole lawsuit. So why did the appellate court allow Garcia to skip the line here?
You're touching on a fundamental rule of appellate law. Appellate courts generally hate interrupting an ongoing case to micromanage discovery disputes. They don't want to be the referees for every little squabble over who gets to depose whom.
Nobody wants to micromanage that.
Exactly. So to get an appellate court to grant a writ of certiorari and intervene immediately, you have to prove two rigorous things. First, that the trial court's order was a departure from the essential requirements of the law, meaning the judge got the law fundamentally wrong.
Okay.
And second, you have to prove irreparable harm.
Meaning, if we wait until the end of the case to fix this, it will be too late. The damage will be permanent.
It's a strict jurisdictional requirement. If you can't prove irreparable harm, the appellate court won't even look at your petition. They'll just dismiss it outright.
So how did Garcia prove irreparable harm in a fight over a deposition?
By pointing straight at the absurdity of that first deposition transcript. The appellate judges looked at the testimony of the clueless president, and they connected the dots.
They saw right through it.
They really did. Because Kaufman, the lawyer, played such a material role in finding the president, and because there are literally no other witnesses, officers, or documents available, Garcia has absolutely no substitute way to get the information he needs.
Wow. If they can't talk to the lawyer, the money is gone forever. The settlement just evaporates into the ether.
Exactly. The appellate court ruled that prohibiting the deposition of this specific attorney under these specific bizarre circumstances would effectively eviscerate Garcia's entire claim.
It totally destroys the case.
Yes, it inflicts a harm that cannot be remedied on a final appeal down the road. Therefore, the irreparable harm standard was met, forcing the appellate court to